team examined the tape and determined that Higgins had died before he'd been hanged. When a human body is suspended from the neck by rope, the feet naturally hang with toes pointed straight down at the ground, former DIA analyst Scott Carmichael explained in an interview for this book. Carmichael had also worked with Della Fiora. The FBI's examination of the videotape established, by contrast, that the colonel's feet projected out with the ankles at right angles, not with toes pointed straight down, Carmichael clarifies. The terrorists put a rope around Higgins' neck and videotaped him that way because they wanted to project power. Higgins' body was not recovered for another 2.5 years when his mummified remains were found in a bag left in a school parking lot in southern Beirut. Della Fiora's signal about the feet had played into the investigation. Higgins's feet were the clue investigators used to prove he'd already been killed, says Carmichael. When Higgins was confirmed dead, Dale Graff was again forced to confront a distressing reality. What good did remote viewing really do? None of the information divined had saved Colonel Higgins's life. Yes, small details had proved correct after the fact, but the information was never of operational use. Remote viewing promised to be useful in intelligence collection. Dale Graff was convinced this was fact. But at times like this, he felt despondent. Higgins was dead, and the remote viewers had, in essence, failed. As 1988 drew to a close, Captain Ed Dames was nearing the end of his assignment at Fort Meade. Declassified logs indicate his anomaly targeting had continued full bore to the end of his tenure, culminating in an anthology of reports entitled Galactic Federation HQs, full of colorful descriptions of three types of entities associated with ET bases at various locations within the solar system. When Dames was transferred out of Sunstreak at the end of the year, he received no recommendations or awards. Shortly before Dames was set to retire, a new recruit arrived at the unit. He was Captain David Morehouse, a former Army Ranger commander. Paul Smith remembers getting along with him right away. He was outgoing and friendly. He had been a successful combat arms officer. He exuded charm. Like Smith, Morehouse was a Mormon. He and Smith attended the same church. He won people's confidence, cultivating them as friends and allies, recalls Smith. Morehouse's commendations immediately placed him in the good graces of his superiors. In his first review, on May 24, 1989, Branch Chief Fern Govan wrote, "His eagerness to learn is equaled only by his ability and desire to be as highly proficient as possible in the pursuit of operational success." In Morehouse's second review, Govan had more praise. "Exercises strong leadership, demands high standards of performance, while ensuring genuine concern as a compassionate leader. A person of high moral fiber, whose word is unquestionable, maintains the highest level of physical fitness." Morehouse had been participating in remote viewing training for roughly a year when several members of the unit noticed odd behavior on his part. "We began to realize Dave was around less and less frequently," says Smith. Viewers Mel Riley, Lynn Buchanan, and Angela Della Fiora reported seeing the office phone number emblazoned on a sign attached to Morehouse's van, advertising a construction company called House Tech. "I fielded at least one phone call from one of Morehouse's prospective customers," says Smith, who remembers telling the caller that the number was not for the House Tech office, but was a government telephone. This kind of problem had been predicted by Jim Salyer, in his Secret Working Papers written several years earlier. Regarding the operational structure of the Fort Meade unit, Salyer observed that some potential disadvantages are that it is composed of mostly military personnel who have time-limited assignments, and that there is little to do during periods where there are no operational assignments. The problem of too much free time was endemic to the unit. It does not appear, in hundreds of declassified documents dating from this time, that Morehouse was ever reprimanded. The unit was rife with contention among personnel, making it difficult to discern how much was merely office politics. While moonlighting was not exemplary behavior, it did not appear to violate the standards of conduct for Department of the Army personnel, which focused more on the prohibition of unauthorized relationships, misuse of government equipment, and gambling. In Morehouse's official performance evaluations, he continued to earn high praise from his superiors and was promoted to major. "Truly outstanding in every respect," wrote Lieutenant Colonel Douglas B. Hudson, a commander at INSCOM headquarters, in Major Morehouse's exit review. "A rare, talented officer with unbelievable abilities. A true workhorse that you want on your team." No one in the unit foresaw that David Morehouse would eventually play a significant role in the downfall of the entire program. In 1989, precipitated by an act of Congress, the DIA acquired a roster of new clients for its remote viewing unit. America had been fighting a so-called war on drugs since the Reagan administration's initiative. Then, in 1989, with the Defense Authorization Act, the military was formally enlisted in the National Drug Control Program. This placed the Department of Defense at the helm of the war on drugs. Almost overnight, a profusion of military assets were part of this protracted effort, including Navy radar frigates and airborne radar pickets, Air Force airborne warning and control systems, and U.S. Customs aviation units, as well as the full force of the Coast Guard. The operation escalated from state to federal and from local to global. In addition to the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DIA's new clients included the Coast Guard, Customs, and the Joint Interagency Task Forces in Florida and California. Key to narcotics work is knowing where to look for the drugs. Remote viewers were brought on board to help interdict cocaine coming into the United States from South America, to see into the cargo holds of huge vessels, and to pinpoint exactly where drugs were being stored. Declassified memos reveal that a new protocol was implemented in this effort, the pre-science invention known as dowsing. The DIA termed its protocol Remote Map Sensing, or RMS. Remote map sensing is an intellectual process in which a person is able to identify the location of an object slash person which is remote to him by simultaneously focusing his attention on the object slash person and concentrating on a map, one memo states. In this case, the objects being sought were cargo vessels. Viewers were encouraged to use a variety of tools historically associated with dowsing. Among them, a pendulum, a weight hung from a string, described in an official memo as a handheld tool that responds by gyrating when the proper location has been found. Each member of the unit was given a thick file folder of articles to read on dowsing, including newspaper stories on how the Marines used dowsing rods to locate tunnel systems built by the Viet Cong during the Vietnam War. each viewer was given a book of instructions titled The Study Guide for Use of the Pendulum as a Focusing Tool. Paul Smith went the extra mile to learn the procedure by attending meetings of the Chesapeake chapter of the American Society of Dowsers, which assembled at a Quaker meeting hall roughly 20 miles north of Fort Meade. Angela Della Fiora developed her own technique, she says. I used my finger to pinpoint a location on a map. For the viewers involved in the DIA's drug interdiction efforts, the top priority task was to locate the big loads of cocaine being trafficked into the states by the Medellin cartel in Colombia. The paranormal components of these drug operations were so classified that they had their own subcompartment within Sunstreak, codenamed Switchplate. Sunstreak was a black program to begin with, and yet deep within the Sunstreak Switchplate classified system, there were additional levels of compartmentalization identifiable only by a single classified code word, one of which is indicated in declassified logs to have been stippled. Even deeper within the Sunstreak Switchplate stippled black program was a compartmented three-tiered level of access: administrative access, normal access, and highest level access. Program material is only transmitted or communicated point to point between named, cleared individuals, notes one declassified cover sheet. Most of the Sunstreak, Switchplate, stippled counter-narcotics programs were eyes only, meaning that information could only be viewed, never copied or written down. The primary client controlling the information was the Army's Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence. Because this information was so highly classified, compartmentalized within a black program that did not officially exist, the DIA's clients wanted to protect their identities. To this end, they often used their own taskers, not the operations managers at Fort Meade. For this work, DIA wrote a briefing manual, some of which has been declassified. The information provided by Switchplate sources is obtained through a unique and highly sensitive collection technique, the DIA manual states. Your care in evaluating this information will ensure that we are better able to access or modify the technology to provide you, the customer, with a better product. The anonymous author of the monograph gave a metaphorical example that unintentionally but brilliantly sums up the conundrum of the anomalous mental phenomena research that had been going on in the post-war era. Sources, like all humans, tend to be attracted to aspects of the target that attract them personally. They also tend to ignore or gloss over aspects which do not attract them. For example, wrote DIA, consider the story of four blind men asked to report the shape of an elephant. One stood in front, felt the trunk, and said that an elephant is actually a huge variety of snake. Another felt the ear and described the elephant as being like a living leaf. Another felt the tail and reported that it is like a long, hairy rope. The fourth man felt one leg and reported that the elephant is a tall, vertical animal shaped like a tree trunk. The point was, and remains, that one's perspective is everything. Each viewer sees only a small part of the whole. How to differentiate between a tail and a rope, an ear and a living leaf, an elephant's leg and a tree trunk. This was the puzzle: how to interpret and manage what people perceive. The DIA advised its clandestine clients to understand that sources using this technology tend to answer questions very literally, and that the customer must understand that the more precisely he or she words a question, the more exact the source's answer will be. Time spans should be as exact as possible. Where will Mr. X be Thursday at 3 p.m.? And when dealing with targets, locations should be as exact as possible. Describe the den of X's home. Still, the problem remained. In military operations, events happen fast. The time spent learning to separate signal from noise, and then deciphering that the rope is really a tail, always seemed to get in the way of using remote viewing information. For this reason, the holy grail of remote viewing was and remains the ability to access alphanumeric information. Numbers, letters, and words were actionable intelligence. But this kind of intelligence was extremely rare. In the history of the government's ESP programs, only a few people had produced alphanumeric information. Now, after years of struggling to keep the program funded, one thing became obvious to Dale Graff and Jack Verona. Providing clients with alphanumeric information that they could act upon was likely going to be the only way the remote viewing program could stay alive. In December 1988, press reports indicated that Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was producing chemical weapons at a facility called Rabta, 60 miles south of Tripoli. The weapons included blister agents and sarin nerve gas, a weapon of mass destruction, WMD. Further reports indicated that President Reagan was considering using force to destroy the Libyan chemical weapons complex. Declassified documents indicate that DIA learned that Gaddafi was set to move a large stockpile of WMDs out of Rabta in anticipation of a possible U.S. airstrike. Angela Della Fiora was assigned to the operation. Because of the sensitivity of the case, Jack Verona sat with her in the viewing room at Fort Meade, an action that incensed many of the other viewers who had experienced no such high-level handling. The only time any of the viewers had sat with Verona was the day after Higgins' kidnapping, when Dames, Smith, and Della Fiora traveled to DIA. Dale Graff was also actively involved. Because of the urgency of the situation, and given that it involved a WMD, Della Fiora was given a prompt to help her focus on a specific geographical location. Graff recalls the single question as being, "Where will a stockpile of weapons outside Tripoli be moved to?" It was one of those sessions where the signal line was very clear, Della Fiora recalls. "I concentrated for a moment. A word came to me and I wrote it down." She handed the paper to Dr. Verona. On the paper, Della Fiora had written potato or patuta, Graff recalls. When Verona asked for clarification, Della Fiora said, "A ship by the name of Potato would arrive in Tripoli to transport chemicals to an eastern Libyan port." Graff explains what happened next. Verona walked into the DIAC with a piece of paper and the word potato or patuta on it and asked the analysts, "Does anyone know what this means?" One analyst spoke up. The analyst said Libya had a vessel in their inventory named Batato, says Graff. 2 days later, New York Times reporter Steven Engelberg broke a story headlined, "U.S. says Libya moves chemicals for poison gas away from plant." Engelberg reported that the officials declined to specify the source of their information. The source was Angela Della Fiora, confirms Graff. "I was told that the U.S. Navy sent a submarine to hunt for Gaddafi's vessel," Della Fiora says. Graf is not at liberty to confirm this. Positive reinforcement of people's work generally affects their abilities. The reverse is also true. There was no question that Angela Della Fiora's work was favored above that of the other viewers. Her results were being shared in congressional meetings, in intelligence committee meetings, and in briefings across the military and intelligence communities. This created its own chicken and egg scenario. Her intelligence information was more likely to be considered by analysts, and she continued to get more tasks and produce actionable results. In the summer of 1989, the results of a particular Della Fiora search and locate effort would become one of the most celebrated cases in the program's 25-year history. It involved a customs agent turned drug smuggler named Charles Frank Jordan. Charles Jordan had worked for the U.S. Customs Service in South Florida as a special agent. In 1986, he was being accused of taking bribes from drug traffickers smuggling big loads of cocaine into the United States. When Jordan realized that law enforcement was onto him, he became a fugitive. For more than 2 years, he remained at large, earning a place on the FBI's Most Wanted Fugitives list. In federal law enforcement circles, a rogue agent on the run is a highly sought-after target. Jordan had been a fugitive for 3 years when in 1989, the Customs Service requested that the DIA's viewers target him. Jordan was believed to be hiding in the Caribbean or South America, customs officials said. All six viewers on the Fort Meade team were asked to locate the fugitive. After multiple sessions, the operations manager wrote a report stating that four viewers had put Jordan in four different locations. Viewer 003 said he was in Mexico, in the coastal area due west of Mexico City, where he lived in a large multi-story building with a red roof as a guest of the owner. Viewer 011 said Jordan was in south central Minnesota between the two small towns of Madalia and Lake Crystal, living in a farmhouse with an adjacent smokehouse. Viewer 025 said Jordan was in Florida in the western coastal area near the southern tip of the state, living in an apartment in a one or two-story clapboard house. Viewer 095 said he was in central Mexico near the town of Ciudad de Rio Grande, living in a large three-story white building with a brown roof. Mexico, Minnesota, Florida? Where to start? My instinct was to go with Angela's information, says Graf. According to declassified memoranda, operations manager Fern Gauvin supervised Angela Della Fiora, while unit secretary Jeannie Betters took notes. Where's the fugitive Charles Jordan? Gauvin asked. He's in Lowell, Wyoming, Della Fiora said. In 2016, she clarified. It just came to me as two words. Fern wanted more information, and I said something like, well, you don't need any more information because that's where he is. There's a Lowell, Massachusetts, said Gauvin. Is that what you mean? Jeannie Betters said, she said Wyoming, Fern. Gauvin asked for more information, but Della Fiora said he'd better end the session immediately. We'd been doing a lot of drug interdiction, Della Fiora recalls. I told Fern I was getting flooded with information, and if I didn't get out of the session right then and there, I was going to put the fugitive Jordan in Florida or the Caribbean. That is, somewhere where the drugs were and where Jordan wasn't, she explains. Gauvin went to the office bookshelves and pulled down a world atlas. He flipped through the index. There's a Lovell, Wyoming, not Lowell, he said. Well, that's probably it, Della Fiora confirmed. Automatic writing is not a science, Angela Della Fiora explained in 2016, and it is definitely not an exact science in the literal or metaphorical sense. When you do automatic writing, you get things phonetically. Lowell sounds like Lovell, at least it did as Della Fiora heard it. Govan sent the information to Dale Graff at DIA. After the success of the Qaddafi chemical weapons assignment, Della Fiora's clear signal information was generally passed along to superiors, according to Graff. A few days later, Fern Govan asked Della Fiora if she could work another session on the fugitive Jordan. "Absolutely not," she recalls saying. "It was the same problem," she clarified in 2016. "Too much overlay on the counter-narcotics operations, which involved scores of customs agents in a myriad of places like South America, the Caribbean, and South Florida." Graff and Verona agreed that Della Fiora's lead was solid and worth following up. Lovell, Wyoming was not a heavily populated area, says Graff. "We arranged to have FBI send the fugitive's photograph around to federal employees at post offices and national parks in the surrounding area." Several weeks passed. Govan approached Della Fiora again. Could she work the fugitive Jordan case one more time? Della Fiora said fine. The signal line came to her right away, she recalled in 2016. Angela said, "If you don't go get him now, you'll lose him. He's moving from Lowell," Graff remembers. She sensed that Jordan was living at or near a campground that had a large boulder at its entrance. And she said that she sensed an old Indian burial ground is located nearby. Customs agent William Green increased the local law enforcement effort regarding the fugitive alert. A ranger at Yellowstone National Park spotted Jordan and notified the FBI. Agents were sent into the field. Graff recalls being on the telephone with the Customs Service when the news broke. They found the fugitive Charles Jordan at a campground located on the border of an old Indian burial ground. He was roughly 50 miles from Lovell, Wyoming. When the FBI retraced Jordan's movements, the Bureau determined he'd been in Lovell, Wyoming a few weeks earlier. Between March 1989 and March 1990, remote viewers conducted 982 counter-narcotics sessions. 565 were training sessions, and 417 were operational. Declassified documents reveal the number of search projects of intelligence value to have been 52%, while 47% were listed as being of no value. Because there is no narrative description of other factors involved in the operations, it is impossible to determine exactly what these numbers meant. But a new conflict loomed on the horizon. In the spring of 1990, the Defense Department began pulling resources from the war on drugs and directing them toward the coming Persian Gulf War. Paul Smith was transferred out of the Fort Meade unit and sent to the war theater in Iraq on an assignment that had nothing to do with remote viewing. He served as part of a helicopter assault unit attached to the 101st Airborne Division and was one of the first U.S. Army units into Iraq. There, he was involved in the capture of Iraqi infantry troops. "He missed the remote viewing unit immensely," he says, "and that his efforts at Fort Meade were, by far, the most interesting assignments in his 20-year Army career." In October 1990, Dale Graff was notified by DIA security that the Sunstreak code name needed to change. Given the classified nature of the program, a name change helped throw off foreign spies seeking information about military intelligence. Graff was allowed to pick the new name from a list of computer-generated words. he settled on Stargate. The wheels of bureaucracy churned, creating a new project review board, a new project oversight panel, and a new scientific oversight committee. Jack Verona was no longer head of the Directorate of Science and Technology. Now he was chief scientist, thereby severing his ties with the Psychoenergetic Phenomena Program. Shortly thereafter, Jack Verona retired after 25 years of service at DIA. In 2011, he was inducted into the DIA's Torchbearers Hall. The new DIA division chief, John Burbridge, gave Dale Graff the position of branch chief at Fort Meade, replacing Fern Govan. Graff would be in charge of the remote viewers now, with close proximity and a hands-on role. Graff saw the creation of this so-called new program, Stargate, as a perfect opportunity to redesign a program to be as operationally effective as possible. This meant drawing heavily from lessons learned, he wrote in an early Stargate briefing. His first order of business was to allow the program to return to its scientific roots. Stargate is a new, dynamic approach for pursuing this largely unexplored area of human consciousness, subconscious interaction, his program overview declared, a document that was distributed to the Intelligence Community Working Group. Stargate planned to undertake research programs that would foster discoveries into how this phenomena work. After 16 years immersed in anomalous mental phenomena programs, Graff knew that until a general theory about the sources and origins of paranormal phenomena was developed, programs like the remote viewing unit would be relegated to the fringe. Thus, Graff wanted to widen the program so it was not limited to remote viewing. Stargate would research a wide range of anomalous mental phenomena, including psychological, physiological, neurophysiological, advanced physics, new wave concepts, and other leading-edge scientific areas. All of the programs would have a strong focus on applications research and an eye toward U.S. national security, Graff wrote. Blue sky thinking would be encouraged. Scientists and researchers would be asked to develop better scientific methodology and evaluation procedures in order to provide DIA with better documentation of activities and plans. The program would also develop a database to track foreign efforts in psychic research, particularly efforts by the Soviets and the Chinese. This database would be available to military and intelligence officers alike. The concept of training also needed to change, wrote Graff, because the attempt to train non-psychic people during Grill Flame and Sunstreak had proved problematic. Stargate would identify individuals with talent, people like Rosemary Smith, Gary Langford, Joe McMonagle, and Angela Della Fiora. The concept of extraordinary human functioning, developed by Albert Stubblebine and John Alexander in the early 1980s, would be reintroduced. Locating the sources of anomalous mental phenomena, such as extraordinary human body functions, extrasensory perception, and psychokinesis, could lead to breakthrough achievements in human potential, he wrote. This is what the Chinese were doing. Graff sought to rid the program of its special access designation. That classification added unnecessary concealment to an already esoteric program, he said, and the draconian rules that came with a black program fostered not just secrecy, but furtiveness. Keeping the psychoenergetic phenomena program so tightly under wraps did more harm than good, he says. As the new branch chief, he hoped that by giving the program limited distribution status, they could dismantle the program's distorted image. He hoped to stimulate other branches of the federal government to engage in similar research. Limited distribution status would help cast a wider net and attract like-minded individuals. At least that was Graf's hope. By the end of the Persian Gulf War, only three remote viewers were left at Fort Meade. In May 1991, a little over a month after war's end, DIA branch chief John Burbridge, Dale Graf, and the three viewers, one of whom was Angela Della Fiora, traveled to England, Germany, and Israel as part of an annual intelligence exchange. The trip to Israel was particularly notable, an exchange between DIA and its Israeli counterparts, remembers Graf. After giving his Stargate briefing to Israeli intelligence in Tel Aviv, British intelligence in London, and German intelligence representatives in the Munich area, Graf felt the future of the Stargate program was on the upswing. But the aspirations, optimism, and confidence about where Stargate was headed couldn't prevent the program from beginning to unravel after a single newspaper story was released by the Associated Press in November of 1991. Chapter 22, Downfall. The beginning of the end of the government's 23-year history in extrasensory perception and psychokinesis began on November 19, 1991, when the Associated Press ran a three-column story under the headline, UN Enlists Psychic Firm to Find Iraq's Weapon Sites. According to the AP, the psychic firm, identified as a private business called SciTech, was run by a retired major in military intelligence named Edward Dames. A United Nations team is turning to extrasensory powers to help it find Saddam Hussein's weapon sites, wrote Washington correspondent Ruth Sinai. The story focused on the work of a UN inspector and army major named Karen Jansen, who was said to have carried with her to Baghdad sketches of two sites where the Iraqi leader had supposedly stashed biological weapons. The sketches had been provided to Jansen by SciTech president Ed Dames, according to the AP. Dames told the news agency that he and five SciTech associates, mostly retired military officers, drew the sketches through remote viewing, the ability to locate and accurately describe unknown things and events from afar. Remote viewing was a U.S. government weapon, said Dames, but remote viewing doesn't require psychic powers. It's more a matter of suppressing one's imagination and concentrating on a target with rigorous discipline, he said. Dames told Ruth Sinai that Jansen had contacted him about Iraq's biological weapon sites after she saw him discuss remote viewing on a Seattle television show. Asked to provide a copy of the invoice for the Weapons of Mass Destruction, WMD, assignment, Dames said he'd provided the information to the UN team for free, but that normally he charged between $6,000 and $8,000 a week. SciTech's mission statement, he explained, was solving the unsolvable, and added that SciTech also trained people to become remote viewers because the talent was a learned technique. According to legal documents filed in California, SciTech had been in business since 1989. The three individuals who signed SciTech's official documents were Ed Dames, David Morehouse, and Mel Riley. The trio, along with Paul Smith, all government employees with secret or top-secret clearances, had been moonlighting their services to private clients. Yes, says Smith, I agreed that as long as no classified information was compromised, and I was not put into any conflict of interest with my military duties, I would be willing to moonlight as a viewer, and I did. He also says he was not violating any military code in doing so. He did not personally work on any SciTech assignments from the UN during the Gulf War, only ones from wealthy individuals interested in solving such mysteries as whether crop circles and the Tunguska explosion over Siberia in 1908 could be attributed to aliens. In 1990, Colonel John Alexander and General Bert Stubblebine, both of whom had retired from the military, joined SciTech's corporate board. It was a mistake, John Alexander said in 2016. Not much attention was paid by the public to what seemed like an anecdotal article by the AP. Major Karen Jansen could not be reached for comment. But at the Pentagon, the fallout was tremendous. General Clapper could not go anywhere without being hounded about the psychic spying program, remembers Alexander. Lieutenant General James Clapper was director of the Defense Intelligence Agency at the time. In June 1993, after 16 consecutive years leading much of the research and operations in government ESP and PK programs, Dale Graff retired. His efforts made him the longest-serving civilian scientist in the program's history. He left a sinking ship. With Graff gone, the speed of the unraveling was swift. News surfaced that Ed Dames and David Morehouse were collaborating with a former Texas newspaper reporter named Jim Mars to write an exposé about the still-classified remote viewing program. But before a draft of the book was completed, Dames and Morehouse were preparing to sue each other. Without Dale Graff, the program really took a downward turn, recalls Angela Della Fiora. Graff's replacement, Albert Girard, thought the unit was totally out of control, she says. He was the kind of government official who wore a three-piece suit to work, and it seemed as if he had inherited something that was way beyond his comfort level. Then, one day in the winter of 1994, a phone call came in from the Pentagon. David Morehouse was being court-martialed by the Army. The military charges against him were serious and included adultery, sodomy, assault, theft of Army property, and conduct unbecoming an officer. Morehouse was being investigated by the Intelligence and Security Command, as well as by the Army Criminal Investigation Division and the Defense Investigative Services. He was facing jail time. Della Fiora was asked to accompany Al Girard to the Pentagon to meet with Morehouse's lawyer. The situation came out of left field, Della Fiora recalls. Morehouse was with the psychic program for a short time. He came and went. Why we were getting dragged into this, nobody knew at the time. Al Girard didn't know Morehouse from the man on the moon. I went along as a character witness because I'd worked alongside him. After his two-year service with the remote viewing unit at Fort Meade, Morehouse had returned to school at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. As part of a master's program, he wrote a thesis on non-lethal weapons, including the use of remote viewing as an intelligence collection tool. Upon graduation, Morehouse received high praise from the deputy commandant. Major Morehouse is the smartest and most dynamic of the three executive officers I have had in the last 24 months, wrote Brigadier General William M. Steele in June 1992. None has worked harder and pushed for excellence with his zeal. He is truly one of a kind. Everyone Dave Morehouse comes into contact with is a better soldier because of his intense professionalism. Morehouse was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and it was there that the troubles arose. He was accused of having had an affair with the wife of his driver, an enlisted man, and having stolen government computer equipment and given it to his married paramour. When Angela Della Fiora was summoned to the Pentagon for a matter related to David Morehouse, it was unclear to her what Morehouse's legal troubles had to do with remote viewing. The crimes he was being accused of occurred more than 3 years after he'd left the program. Angela Della Fiora recalls the meeting at the Pentagon. "The lawyer told us that what it boiled down to was that the defense was going to take the position that remote viewing had made David Morehouse crazy," she says. Some months later, Della Fiora accompanied Girard to a preliminary court-martial hearing at Fort Bragg. She had been called as an expert witness on the DIA's remote viewing program. "The entire situation was absurd," she recalls. "Here I was, testifying on DIA's behalf. Here I was, psychic, remembering back to when people accused me of being crazy because I said I was psychic and that I had a third eye. Here was Morehouse saying he'd gone crazy because the Army made him a psychic. This was his defense as to why he'd slept with another man's wife and stolen government computer equipment. It felt like some kind of comedy of errors," she said, "an extravagant, improbable farce." The Army did not accept Morehouse's contention that remote viewing had made him crazy, and the judge ordered the court-martial proceedings to commence. In early April 1994, Morehouse checked into Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. He told doctors there that evil demons possessed him, a result of working in the remote viewing unit at the Intelligence and Security Command, he said. He was assigned to Ward 54, the inpatient psychiatric facility. In June, Paul Smith received a call from Debbie Morehouse, David's wife, whom he knew from the Mormon church they both attended. "She asked me to visit Dave at Walter Reed," Smith recalls. "Since I was now a bishop's counselor in my local Mormon congregation, she was hoping I could offer advice about how the church might be able to help her and her family in their time of crisis." Smith traveled to Walter Reed. On June 6, he met Debbie in the hospital waiting room, and together they walked down the corridor to David Morehouse's hospital room. Debbie told Smith that her husband was preparing to do an interview with 60 Minutes, in which he would say that the DIA's remote viewing program at Fort Meade had made him crazy. Howard Rosenberg, one of the 60 Minutes staff, had already been to Walter Reed to interview Dave, Smith recalls. Dave was arranging to be released from the hospital for a day of leave so 60 Minutes reporters could interview him in depth. Smith recalls thinking this was a very bad idea. The remote viewing unit was a special access program that was highly classified, and revealing anything about it could be a violation of the Espionage Act of 1917. The entire situation struck Smith as tragic, and he recalls being unnerved by how terrible his old friend looked, wearing a hospital gown, unshaven, and with a caged look in his eyes. He admitted to the affair, calling it a stupid mistake. He said he was being unfairly prosecuted. He described evil spirits that beset him all the time. "But the crux of the matter," says Smith, "was that he wanted me to testify that remote viewing had caused the mental problems he was manifesting. He hoped that if he were diagnosed as mentally ill, traceable to a military-related cause, he would be granted a medical retirement rather than being sent to the military prison at Fort Leavenworth." Smith told Morehouse he could not do that. "Since no one else from the unit had ever gone crazy," Smith explained in 2015, "it seemed unlikely that if Dave really was having mental problems, that remote viewing caused it." In late June, David Morehouse was transferred from the psychiatric facility at Walter Reed to the psychiatric ward at Womack Army Hospital at Fort Bragg, where the court-martial was to proceed elsewhere on base. Prior to transfer, the Walter Reed Army Medical Sanity Board concluded, "It is the opinion of the Sanity Board that Major Morehouse did not have a severe mental disease of defect, and that his clinical psychiatric diagnoses are major depression and alcohol abuse episodic in remission." 60 Minutes decided not to air the show it was working on. Because the DIA remote viewing program was still classified, America's oldest and most watched TV news magazine could find no other sources to corroborate that the program even existed. No one would talk about it on the record, 60 Minutes producer Howard Rosenberg later recalled, and the principal promoter of the story, i.e., David Morehouse, and of the program, was of questionable credibility and seemed to me to have multiple agendas. The Morehouse saga ended in January 1995 when he proposed resigning his commission in lieu of being tried before the court-martial. His proposal was accepted in the best interests of the Army, and he was discharged from the service under other than honorable conditions. Congress ordered an evaluation of the Stargate program by an outside research firm, and the CIA was put in charge as custodian. The agency hired the American Institutes for Research to conduct a review of Stargate and an investigation into government's decades-long research into ESP and its potential for intelligence use. Most of the work in psychokinesis was left out of the report. The results were presented in two documents totaling 232 pages. Studies of paranormal phenomena have nearly always been associated with controversy, the researchers warned, and described how the U.S. government's efforts were no different. Conceptually, remote viewing would seem to have tremendous potential utility for the intelligence community, it was noted. But after comprehensive review, the analyst found only a compelling argument against continuation of the research program within the intelligence community. The reason was a restatement of what had been said all along. Although laboratory studies demonstrated the existence of a paranormal phenomenon, remote viewing, in the absence of evidence regarding the sources or origins of the phenomenon, there was no rationale for continuance. The remote viewing phenomenon has no real value for intelligence operations, the researchers wrote. One must question whether any further applications can be justified. It was a curious situation. The researchers were given less than 2 months to review nearly a quarter of a century's worth of work. One of the team leaders on the report was the psychologist Ray Hyman, a founding member of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, and a critic of the government's psychic research ever since he had investigated Uri Geller on behalf of the Advanced Research Projects Agency back in 1972. Because the time was so limited, the researchers did not examine any of the research or reports done at SRI in the 1970s. It was later revealed that the American Institutes for Research based its evaluation on roughly 40 sessions conducted in 1994 and 1995 by three randomly chosen remote viewers. On June 31, 1995, the CIA ordered DIA to cease all Stargate operations. Angela Della Fiora's last task for the Psychoenergetic Phenomena Program was to travel to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, to box up the documents for the National Archives. In October, CIA declassified 262 documents related to the psychic research programs, some dating back to 1972. Starting in the year 2000, the CIA began to declassify and release tens of thousands of additional documents. An untold number remain inaccessible. 5 months after the original CIA order, on November 28, 1995, a Nightline expose made the Stargate program public. Ted Koppel interviewed the DIA's Dale Graff and the CIA's Robert Gates on national television. Graff defended the integrity of the programs. Gates downplayed the significance of it all. Koppel also interviewed customs agent William Green, who confirmed the amazing story of how one DIA psychic, an unnamed woman, had located one of the FBI's most wanted fugitives, Charles Frank Jordan, thereby bringing closure to what had been an otherwise futile 2-year manhunt. The story generated additional press in local and international news reports. The general tenor was skeptical and satirical. Former DIA director General James Clapper told reporters that he and his three predecessors had all tried to kill the program. "It just didn't feel appropriate for DIA to be doing anything like that," he said. "It was just too far out at the leading edge of technology to maintain very well as an ongoing intelligence activity. But we got directions from Congress every year in our appropriation and specific language to sustain the operation." After a few months in the spotlight, the public's interest in what was generally referred to as the government's psychic spy program seemed to wane. But it was interesting that General Clapper categorized the Defense Department's ESP and PK research as leading-edge technology, not leading-edge parapsychology. The year 1995 marked the end of another era when Andrea Puharic died tragically, alone, impoverished, and under threat of eviction from the North Carolina estate of his last benefactor, R.J. Reynolds. Reynolds, heir to the tobacco fortune, had died 7 months before, and Puharic refused to leave the 1,000-acre estate, Devotion, where he'd been living as a scientist in residence. The once brilliant medical doctor and research pioneer, whose Puharic theory had set the CIA and the Defense Department's psychic research programs in motion in the early 1950s, had somehow lost his way. To the end, Puharic wrote papers in service of his theory that extraterrestrials were trying to send messages to humans through psychic people, and that extremely low frequency, or ELF waves, were responsible for the sicknesses of the age. Surrounded by filth and feral cats, early one evening in the winter of 1995, Puharic fell down a set of stairs to his death. He was 76. According to the Winston-Salem Journal, he had been suffering from dementia, kidney failure, and the onset of gangrene in one leg. And so, the 20th century chapter on secret U.S. government research into extrasensory perception and psychokinesis came to a close. The scientists and psychics went their separate ways. For some, the quest to understand the phenomena continued to be an epic pursuit. For others, it remained an affliction, like a curse. Members of the scientific skeptics community saw victory in the program's exposure, cancellation, and subsequent ridicule. But for a growing number of Americans, the revelation that the government was keenly interested in anomalous mental phenomena renewed its appeal. With the increasing popularity of late-night talk radio shows like Art Bell's Area 2000 and the growth of the internet, paranormal topics gained new traction and evolved. But what of the military and intelligence communities? Efforts to use prophecy, prediction, an extrasensory perception for military gain, is as old as civilization itself. To see the future, to know the unknowable, has been an ageless obsession. It is as controversial in the modern era as it was in 585 BC, when Greek tribes fought the first sacred war over who would control the oracle at Delphi. Regular people and world leaders alike have coveted esoteric knowledge since time immemorial. Would the U.S. government begin the 21st century any differently? Will modern technology unravel the mystery of anomalous mental phenomena once and for all? Or will the search be forever unresolved, like Nietzsche's eternal return? Part 4. The Modern Era. What is past is prologue. William Shakespeare. Chapter 23. Intuition, premonition, and synthetic telepathy. Are ESP and PK real? Back in the early 1950s, when the U.S. government's post-war research into them was just beginning to take off, the Nobel laureate Wolfgang Pauli and the psychiatrist Carl Jung had a lively conversation about the phenomena. The two men were discussing a paper that had recently been written by physicist Robert A. McConnell called ESP, Fact or Fancy? Jung remarked to Pauli how some age-old mysteries never change. As is only to be expected, Jung said, every conceivable kind of attempt has been made to explain away these results, which seem to border on the miraculous and frankly impossible. But all such attempts come to grief on the facts, and the facts refuse so far to be argued out of existence. The physicist and the psychiatrist could have been having this conversation in 2017. For 7 decades, the CIA and the Department of Defense have been actively conducting research on anomalous mental phenomena. A large body of reliable experimental evidence points to the inescapable conclusion that extrasensory perception does exist as a real phenomenon, the CIA concluded in 1975, albeit characterized by rarity and lack of reliability. The agency ultimately canceled its program. There exists no satisfactory theoretical understanding of these phenomena. Present theories, of which there are many, are both speculative and unsubstantiated. Without a theory, the CIA was left with hypothesis or conjecture. A decade later, in 1986, the Army concluded similarly that its ESP and PK researchers and program managers had succeeded in documenting general anomalies worthy of scientific interest, but that, in the absence of confirmed paranormal theory, paranormality could be rejected a priori. Still, laboratory research operations continued, but in 1995, a joint CIA Defense Department-sponsored review of the government's ESP and PK programs resulted in the program's cancellation based on this same paradox. Although a statistically significant effect of the phenomena has been observed in the laboratory, the laboratory studies do not provide evidence regarding the sources or origins of the phenomenon. Remote viewing is vague and ambiguous, the scientific reviewers of the CIA Defense Department programs wrote, making it difficult, if not impossible, for the technique to yield information of sufficient quality and accuracy. No source, no origins, no general theory. Carl Jung had something important to say about this notion of possibility versus impossibility. The so-called possibility of such events is of no importance whatever, for the criterion of what is possible in any age is derived from that age's rational assumptions. What was possible in the early 1950s, when the CIA and the Defense Department began its ESP and PK research, is light years from what is possible today. Today's Defense Department programs in anomalous mental phenomena research leverage modern technology. They exist in research domains involving cognition, perception, and the human brain, and have been retooled and rebranded as distinctly 21st century pursuits. They fall under the rubric of anomalous human cognition, and the research is being conducted not by parapsychologists, but by neurophysiologists, neurobiologists, information technologists, computer engineers, and other scientists whose areas of research did not exist as such in the 1950s. These professions have been made possible by the advent of certain technologies and the astonishing speed of technology's advance. In the late 1940s, when Dr. Andrea Puharic first began researching ESP for the Department of Defense, home radio technology was just 20 years old. 30 years later, in 1976, NASA landed a spacecraft on Mars. 10 years after that, high-temperature superconductivity was discovered, opening the way for order-of-magnitude increases in faster, more efficient computer technology that could record, produce, and analyze information. In 1998, automated DNA sequencing was patented. In 2009, NASA launched the Kepler Space Observatory to survey the Milky Way galaxy and discover Earth-sized planets orbiting other stars. All this technology is the product of the human brain. We live in an age totally transformed by the human brain, and yet humans and their brains are still relatively the same. Outer space is now known to humans in ways unimaginable in the 1950s. Inner space is still lodged in the Dark Ages. What consciousness is and how it works in the brain remain as puzzling to scientists today as chemistry was to early man. There presently exists a huge gap between where researchers are on a hypothesis for anomalous mental phenomena and where the science needs to be for them to move toward general theory. But it took more than 1,000 years for man to move from the hypothesis that the sun, not Earth, was the center of our solar system to the general theory of Copernican heliocentrism. Will modern technology allow for more interest in scientific research into the paranormal, or will the stigma prevail? If the stigma regarding ESP and PK research were removed from the world of science, what might be uncovered? In 2014, the Office of Naval Research embarked on a 4-year, $3.85 million research program to explore the phenomena it calls premonition and intuition, or spidey sense for sailors and marines. We have to understand what gives rise to this so-called sixth sense, says Peter Squire, a program officer in ONR's Expeditionary Maneuver Warfare and Combating Terrorism Department. Today's Navy scientists place less emphasis on trying to understand the phenomena theoretically and more on using technology to examine the mysterious process, which Navy scientists assure the public is not based on superstition. If the researchers understand the process, there may be ways to accelerate it, and possibly spread the powers of intuition throughout military units, says Dr. Squire. The Pentagon's focus is to maximize the power of the sixth sense for operational use. If we can characterize this intuitive decision-making process and model it, then the hope is to accelerate the acquisition of these skills, says Lieutenant Commander Brent Old of ONR's Warfighting Performance Department for Human and Bioengineered Systems. Are there ways to improve premonition through training? He asks. According to the Pentagon, the program was born of field reports from the war theater, including a 2006 incident in Iraq, when Staff Sergeant Martin Richburg, using intuition, prevented carnage in an IED, or improvised explosive device, incident. Commander Joseph Cohn, a program manager at the Naval Office, told the New York Times, "These reports from the field often detailed a sixth sense or spidey sense that alerted them to an impending attack or IED, or that allowed them to respond to a novel situation without consciously analyzing the situation." More than a decade later, today's Defense Department has accelerated practical applications of this concept. Active duty Marines are being taught to hone precognitive skills in order to preempt snipers, IED emplacers, and other irregular assaults using advanced perceptual competences that have not been well studied. Because of the stigma of ESP and PK, the nomenclature has changed, allowing the Defense Department to distance itself from its remote viewing past. Under the Perceptual Training Systems and Tools banner, extrasensory perception has a new name in the modern era, sensemaking. In official Defense Department literature, sensemaking is defined as a motivated, continuous effort to understand connections, which can be among people, places, and events, in order to anticipate their trajectories and act effectively. Over decades, wars change location and weapons design evolves, while man's perceptual capacities remain relatively close to what they have been for thousands of years. 50 years ago in Vietnam, Joe McMonagle used his sixth sense to avoid stepping on booby traps, falling into punji pits, and walking into Viet Cong ambushes. His ability to sense danger was not lost on his fellow soldiers, and the power of his intuitive capabilities spread throughout his military unit. Other soldiers had confidence in this subconscious ability and followed McMonagle's lead. In a life-or-death environment, there was no room for skepticism or ignominy. If it saved lives, it was real. Since 1972, CIA and DOD research indicates that premonition or precognition appears to be weak in some, strong in others, and extraordinary in a rare few. Will the Navy's contemporary work on sense-making, the continuous effort to understand the connections among people, places, and events, finally unlock the mystery of ESP? Might technology available to today's defense scientists reveal hypotheses not available to scientists in an earlier age? At Naval Hospital Bremerton in Washington State, defense scientists and military researchers are exploring cognition and perception in soldiers' virtual dream states. Starting in 2011, as part of a research program called Power Dreaming, soldiers plagued by PTSD-related nightmares have used biofeedback techniques similar to those studied by Colonel John Alexander in the Intelligence and Security Command's Beyond Excellence program under General Albert Stubblebine. For today's Navy, biofeedback has been updated with 21st century virtual reality technology that did not exist 30 years ago. Sponsored by the Naval Medical Research Center, the Power Dreaming Program involves a process called cognitive behavioral treatment for warrior trainees. Participants are active duty soldiers suffering from PTSD-related nightmares who are eligible to be sent back to the battlefield. The method, called re-dreaming, is alleged to be a learned technique that produces changes in the way one's brain processes information. Its goal is to teach trainees to transform their debilitating nightmares into empowering dreams using biofeedback techniques and computer technology. Biofeedback, born in 1962, draws on the idea that the human brain, millions of years in the making, can benefit from seeing itself work in real time. Some of the life processes the trainee can see in real time are his brain waves, heart rate, muscle tension, skin conductance, and pain perception. The process goes like this. When the soldier wakes up from a nightmare, he gets out of bed and goes to a nearby government-issued computer. He puts on 3D goggles and straps a heart rate variability biofeedback device onto his forearm so that biofeedback can be integrated into the re-dreaming process. Hooked up to these two devices, the soldier opens a software program called the Book of Dreams. With a few clicks on the keyboard, he enters the virtual world, Second Life. A soldier's first power dreaming session will begin with a virtual scenario crafted to simulate the event that likely caused the PTSD nightmares. It features an avatar of the warrior trainee, a 3D human cartoon of the self. In one of the Book of Dreams training videos, a soldier's avatar is seen driving a Humvee behind another Humvee along a narrow mountain pass in a place that looks like Afghanistan. The first Humvee is hit by an IED, and the avatar soldier in the second Humvee watches the explosion happen. All around him, people die and bodies fly. The soldier's avatar tries to help a dying colleague who appears to be missing his legs, but fails. The trainee is instructed to look at his biofeedback information, which appears on graphs on the computer screen, and to begin creating or re-dreaming a new narrative. Using the Book of Dreams software, the trainee can make his avatar run, walk, or fly away from the carnage to any pleasant environment imaginable. New geographical scenarios can be set at the beach, in the jungle, on a mountain, even in an underwater dream world filled with fish. The Book of Dreams allows the avatar to share his utopic virtual world with human or animal companions, including real pets like a dog, or imagined ones like a dragon. The warrior trainee can customize the weather, the time of day, and the background music. In the Navy training video available to journalists, the music is distinctly Chinese. While moving through this pleasant virtual world, the trainee is instructed to observe the real-time biofeedback data on his computer as the re-dream continues. This information is also monitored and tracked by naval medical research doctors. Can humans alter their consciousness and change their dreams? The Navy thinks so. Using one's mind to change the chemistry of one's brain is psychokinesis dressed up in a new name for a new age: power dreaming. Government programs that claim to harness the power of the mind to influence matter exist across the Defense Department today. The Pentagon currently supports more than 50 Qigong-based programs for soldiers and veterans, the majority of whom suffer from PTSD. But the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services still consider Qigong unproven as medicine, and the NIH cautions that so-called energy medicine can improve outcomes, have no effect on outcomes, and worsen outcomes with respect to healing effects. Scientific skeptics insist that Qigong and all forms of traditional Chinese medicine are chicanery, including acupuncture and acupressure. The belief in the mind's ability to affect the health of the body is pseudoscience, according to the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, successor to the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. The Army and the Marines appear to disagree. The Operation Warrior Wellness Program, offered at Army and Marine bases and Veterans Administration medical centers across the country, teaches transcendental meditation to PTSD sufferers. The TM-based Resilient Warrior Program has been the subject of 340 peer-reviewed studies and has received more than $26 million in grants from the National Institutes of Health. Key findings of the program, with its NIH caveat, unproven as medicine, include a 40% to 55% reduction in symptoms of PTSD and depression, a 42% decrease in insomnia, 30% reported improvement in satisfaction with quality of life, and a 25% reduction in plasma cortisol levels. The man behind Operation Warrior Wellness is the film director David Lynch, who has been meditating since 1973, twice a day, every day. It has given me effortless access to unlimited reserves of energy, creativity, and happiness deep within. This level of life is sometimes called pure consciousness. It is a treasury, and this level of life is deep within all of us, says Lynch. This drives skeptics wild. The Skeptics Dictionary describes Lynch's efforts to help traumatized soldiers recover from PTSD through meditation as being as effective as sharing ice cream cones. At least one study has found negative health effects from meditation, the dictionary's author Robert Todd Carroll writes, including feeling addicted to meditation, uncomfortable kinesthetic sensations, mild dissociation, feelings of guilt, psychosis-like symptoms, grandiosity, elation, destructive behavior, suicidal feelings, defenselessness, fear, anger, apprehension, and despair. At the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, and the U.S. Army, scientists are building technology-based mental telepathy systems called synthetic telepathy for the modern era. Under the rubric of brain-computer interface technology, the goal, says the Defense Department, is to enable future soldiers to communicate by thought alone. Present-day brain measuring and recording technologies, like electroencephalography, EEG, have advanced to the extent that the brain's alpha rhythms, electrical oscillations, that predominantly originate from the occipital lobe, can be detected, translated into a computer-based speech recognition system, and transmitted to another person at a remote location. With a $4 million grant from the Army Research Office, scientists at the University of California, Irvine, are at work on synthetic telepathy helmets for the Defense Department to allow soldiers to Tell machines to do what they want by telepathically thinking about it, as reported in Digital Journal in May 2013. Initially, communication would be based on a limited set of words or phrases that are recognized by the system, says Program Director Michael DeZumra, chairman of the Department of Cognitive Sciences at the university. It would involve more complex language and speech as the technology is developed further. This synthetic telepathy technology builds off of work pioneered in the early 1960s by physicist Edmund M. Dewan of the Air Force Cambridge Research Laboratories in Bedford, Massachusetts. Motivated by a desire to gain philosophical insight into the nature of consciousness, Dewan trained himself and members of his staff to modulate the brain's alpha rhythms. They practiced until they were able to control their own brain waves at will and, hooked up to 1960s state-of-the-art machinery, filmed the results of their experiments, which can presently be viewed on YouTube using the keywords Brainwave Control Device by Edmund Dewan. After advanced training, Dewan was able to imagine individual letters of the alphabet in Morse code and then send these coded signals to machinery, first letters, then words, and finally phrases. Dewan's first Morse code message took 25 seconds per letter to transmit and record. The phrase was, "I can talk." Upon authentication of this seminal laboratory experiment in 1964, the Washington Post carried a page one above the fold article titled, "Man's Brainwaves Can Talk, Overcoming Speech Barriers." At the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, iLabs, at the University of Washington in Seattle, similar studies are underway. If the first milestone toward synthetic telepathy was to compose messaging using thought alone, the next step was to be able to send those messages to a designated recipient, human or machine, using thought alone. Dr. Andrea Stocco, a co-director at the laboratory, explains, "Evolution has spent a colossal amount of time to find ways for us and other animals to take information out of our brains and communicate it to other animals in the forms of behavior, speech, and so on."